I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Interview. And today I'm sitting down with Ken Burns, the gigantic documentarian who made us think about the Civil War, baseball, jazz, national parks, the Vietnam War, American immigration policy, and now, as we are about to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the United States, the American Revolution. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about PBS funding, too, because he's a big advocate, and that obviously rubs up against us libertarians. So, Ken, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you very much for having me, Nick. Great to be back.
So, let's start with the American Revolution. You have said this is the story that we as a nation keep returning to. What did you feel that Americans were either getting wrong or that needed to be refreshed in this series?
Nothing that we're getting wrong or refreshed. We don't start out with the idea that somehow you have to make a film to be a corrective. We want to make a film because I wanted to understand more about the revolution. Yep. But it is true, our revolution is a kind of Madison Avenue produced, sanitized version. It's bloodless, it's gallant, it's encrusted with the barnacles of sentimentality. It's about guys in Philadelphia thinking great thoughts. And those great thoughts are super important in 76 and 1787. But it's a bloody, bloody revolution. Yep. It's a bloody civil war. And it's the fourth global war, and I don't think Americans appreciate this, over the prize of North America.
So when you say it's a global war, because we get the revolution we need, right? We tell the story as things change. And we think more globally now than we did when I was a kid in school.
It's not about the American Revolution. The French and Indian War, which everyone else on Earth calls the Seven-Year War, was the third war over the prize of North America. The great empires, Britain, Spain, the Netherlands are competing for it. When you say prize, you mean the land. Yeah. The land is actually occupied for thousands of years by many different nations who then complicate the story. So if you're an 8th grade or 11th grade and you got a test, you get an A if you say taxes and representation, and that must totally appeal to you, but it's really about Indian land and taxes and representation. So it means that there's a much more complicated dynamic. We think of it as bloodless. It is a horrible, bloody civil war in a way that our civil war is not. Our civil war is a sectional war, and civil wars involve huge numbers of civilian deaths. And outside of Missouri and eastern bleeding Kansas, there's almost no civilian deaths. Gettysburg, which is the biggest battle ever fought in North America, has, I think, 2 civilian deaths. Right. And just recently, someone was challenging me, they think it's only one.
Some people watch the battle. It was spectator sport.
All the time, and that happens. They came out for the first battle of Bull Run, or Manassas, as the Confederates called it, with picnic baskets, expecting to see the total rout of the rebels. Yeah. The opposite happened in this case, and they and the army were chased already all the way back to Washington. But this is a very bloody civil war, our revolution, and there are patriots killing loyalists and loyalists killing patriots, and both patriots and loyalists killing those called disaffected people who want to keep their heads down and do nothing, the libertarians of the time.
Yes.
And so it is a complex story. And on top of this, it's still a war in which other empires, though Britain has, be careful what you wish for, won the Seven Years' War. There's France that's trying to rebuild, and Spain that's trying to rebuild, the Netherlands. They all eventually come in on our side against the British in the American Revolution. So it's fought not just in the 13 colonies, but in the much more profitable Caribbean and in the subcontinent, in the Mediterranean, around France and off the coast of Britain, and in what is Southeast Asia. So this is an incredibly global story that we've managed to reduce down to just our part, great men in Philadelphia.
Right, and it's somewhat understandable that the Americans focus on the American part. But as you were saying, I mean, you have been, incredibly helpful in terms of kind of creating a history from below, or, not the top-down history.
Well, this is a top-down history, and we have many, many familiar, you'd call them bold-faced names.
But what I'm saying
is, we want to remove the opacity from them, because they become marble statues, as the historian Jane Kamensky said. That does us no good to just worship people for no reason. They're very complicated and interesting, and without George Washington, for example, we don't have a country. But we introduce scores scores of other voices of people that I had never heard of, and I'm fairly confident that you have never heard of, that are part of this incredibly dramatic and interesting dynamic of our American Revolution that makes it more interesting and truer.
Right. You know, one of the things, Jess, as you were talking, the thing that stuck out the most to me when I was watching it is like, oh, Spain actually played an important role in sealing the British loss. And I was like, that can't be right, because I went to Catholic grammar school, and this is one of the reasons why I have an abiding history and interest in American history, is that if you went to Catholic school, and this was in the 70s mostly, you received an alternative history of America, because it was very focused on the Catholics, who really don't matter that much, you know, ideologically, or from, you know, there was one signer of the Declaration who was Catholic. So we learned all about the Spanish people, you know, Columbus, because he sailed for Spain, but he was Italian, and most importantly, he was Catholic, and the French explorers. And the Spanish actually kind of made a big deal. Like, I had never heard that before. And that seems to me like one of the...
There's some actions. There's actions in the Gulf of Mexico around what is now Louisiana and Alabama and Mobile, a Spanish force in the most diverse force ever assembled of Native Americans, of blacks, of Creoles, of other Caribbeans, of American patriots and other, take over Pensacola, which was then the capital of West Florida, and it falls. And it's less strategically important to the story. The fact that Spain is involved is going to complicate Britain's dominance in the sea. The big deal is the French. You give us essentially the equivalent of $30 billion in supplies. They lend an army, they lend a navy. That navy is incredibly important just before the fall of Yorktown, and the army is there laying
but
siege
all of
to
these
Yorktown.
Countries too, I mean, these, and they're different empires, actually. I mean, along with the British Empire, maybe, you know, the Dutch, well, I guess by that point it
was... Well, Spain
was
has the British has the most far-flung empire.
Right.
Spain has the largest empire.
Right. And the French were also on the move. But one of the ironies is that all of these countries, they want Britain to lose, but they also, you know, particularly the French and Spanish, they don't want all of their holdings in the Caribbean or in the New World to be like, oh, you know what, we should revolt too.
The Buddhists have a saying, the clever man can sell water by the river. Mm-hmm. The Americans did an amazingly clever thing. They convinced a Catholic monarch to support a Protestant Republican rebellion that was going against another monarch. And they did it, and it was successful, and it was doomed the French monarchy.
Right. How, you know, can you talk a bit about how the you know, the most basic contradiction of the American Revolution in many ways is that it's fought in the name of liberty and freedom, and it is being fought by a slave, you know, by people who own slaves. How does that play out throughout the story? And how does that change, you know, it obviously being African-American in the North is different than the South, although slavery is legal everywhere. You know, how does that complicate the way that we understand the American Revolution and the way that we should understand it?
Well, we should understand it in all its complications. Mm-hmm. And that's what always makes a good story, is the complications. Shakespeare's tragedies and comedies would not work if they weren't complicated. I have a neon sign in my editing room that says, it's complicated. The fact that you can sort of try to soft sell some of this stuff seems incredibly foolhardy. Slavery is legal from New Hampshire to Georgia. The interesting thing is that the 13 colonies are only half of the 26 colonies that Britain has in North America. The other 13 are in the Caribbean. They are immensely profitable because they're dependent on slave labor. 90% of Jamaica and the Barbados are enslaved people. Only Virginia and the Carolinas are modestly profitable. We're the least profitable, but we're the most populous, and we manufacture things, and we trade. We're healthy. We're literate. We've got a lot of things going for us, and we're the foothold on this continent that everybody wants the land. I mean, when we start a Congress, we don't say it's the Eastern Seaboard Congress. We don't put George Washington in charge of the Eastern Seaboard Army. We call it the Continental Army. We call it the Continental Congress. We know where we're going. And in the midst of the 2.5 to 3 million Americans that are there are 500,000 enslaved and free African Americans. Now, for many people, what's happening is that this is an argument between British people over rights. They don't feel their rights sufficiently recognized with regard to taking Native American land, with regard to an outrageous gesture made to the Canadian provinces, which are Catholic and French, and with regard to taxation and representation. But because this is in the Enlightenment, all of a sudden these British rights get broken out into universal rights, the scholar Christopher Brown said. So now we're talking about rights that everybody has, meaning life, liberty, and equality, and all of these things, freedom, and that is heard not just by the sort of aristocracy that's planning this, you know, resistance, but everybody, including you know, Jane Comiskey, the scholar, says, you know, the liberty talk is leaky, and it's heard by those people who want it most. So yeah, there's a huge internal contradiction. The conservative scholar Yuval Levin points out that when you say all men are created equal, the word "all" is what's going to break down the doors. The floodgates are open the second you express these universal rights. And even though it's 89 years before slavery has ended in the United States, even though it's an insanely irresponsible 144 years before women get the vote, all of those things are going to happen. And so the walls of Jericho are broken down by this revolution. But is it contradictory? Are there aspects of it that are hypocrisy? But the legal scholar Maggie Blackhawk said that the Declaration is deeply significant to people at the margins, Native Americans, women, enslaved and free black people who basically want to drink at that trough of liberty and are will be denied for some time, but have done nothing to diminish their interest in that.
Now, this series lands a few years after the 1619 Project was launched by the New York Times. You've talked about that in the past as journalism, which asks questions but doesn't really provide answers. It's provocative. It has also been followed up by Trump in his first term launched something called the 1776 Project, which if the 1619 Project seemed to flatten everything into the American Revolution was actually fought to preserve slavery, and by kind of extension, the American Project is irredeemable because at its very root is something bad. And then you have, you know, the 1776 Project, which continues pace in Trump's second term, where he is trying to get rid of, you know, morally complicated scenarios and Smithsonian institutions and whatnot. Do you feel like we're ready as a country, or have we always been ready for for that conversation you're talking about, where history is really complicated?
Everybody is interested in the complicated stories. You know, conservatives are supposed to love the series Yellowstone, which has a huge patriarch who is very wise and very good and a murderer.
He's a sociopath. I never understood why.
His daughter is very strong and equally sociopathic. He has two sons. One is married to a Native American whose dynamic informs most of the series. The other son is Benedict Arnold.
Right.
He's got a former that the daughter's in love with, and under him are a crew of ranch hands that are black and white, male and female, gay and straight, and surrounding them is the Native American dynamic of ownership, and beyond that is greed for land. Right. So this is people, of course, want complicated stories. The problem is, if you call balls and strikes, you cannot impose some lens with which to see everything. It always fails, regardless of the intentions, the degree of scholarship involved, or whatever, because it's a round peg that doesn't fit in a square hole. So we call balls and strikes. We live in a world in which it's all a highlight film. In a highlight film, Babe Ruth hits a home run.
Right.
In real life, Babe Ruth strikes out more than he hits home runs, and he comes to bat once every 9 times, which means, as the recent World Series just proved, that it might be the second baseman who is an important part of this story. Right. So you cannot say it is always one thing, because you will immediately find right. you're presented with a contradiction that doesn't make your neat compact theories work. So you ignore neat compact theories, mm-hmm. which don't work, and you call balls and strikes. Is Washington complicated? Yes. Yep. He's deeply flawed. He owes hundreds of human beings. He is rash on the battlefield. He makes a couple of really, at least two really bad tactical mistakes, but we don't have a country without him. He's able to inspire men to fight in the dead of night. He's able to convince Georgians and New Hampshireites that they aren't from their separate countries, right. but they are Americans. He's able to pick subordinate talent without fear of jealousy. In fact, he picks generals who are better than him, including mm-hmm. Nathaniel Greene and Benedict Arnold, and he defers to Congress, though he has the rectitude of a god. Benjamin Rush said every other monarch would look like a valet de chambre next to him, and more importantly, he gives up power twice. This is an important human yeah. being without whom we don't have him. But it doesn't mean you can't also include all of the uncomfortable aspects of it, because that's what you do in good drama. Keats said that Shakespeare had negative capability, this ability to hold intention and not decide, which is what we all mm-hmm. want to do when we live in a binary world where it's a one or a zero, or it's good or bad, it's red state or blue mm-hmm. state. You want to decide, and in fact, human life demands that you have what Keats said Shakespeare have, which is negative capability to hold these twin things in tension. Tom Boswell, the great sports writer for the Washington Post, said this when we were confronting the steroids era in an update of our baseball series. But it applies to human life. And so we don't go in with any isms. We draw from scholars, five generations yeah. of scholars who from every know something about the British Empire, its wealth in the Caribbean, who know about native tribes and the individuality of those tribes that are as distinct from each other as France is from Prussia or Virginia. Virginia is from right. Massachusetts, and to respect that complexity, but at the same time, what it forbids you to do just by the sheer understanding it is to say it's all this one thing.
Right.
It just doesn't work. It's I mean, the English and history have had, you know, certain fashions of historiography right. and history. Sometimes it's Marxist, sometimes it's Freudian, sometimes right. it's deconstruction, semiotics, queer studies, Afrocentrism. Mm-hmm. They're all legitimate ways to try to understand something, but it is like a man describing one aspect of the elephant.
Right.
We're in the job of saying, this is what the whole elephant looks like.
Well, I think about this too, and I'd be curious if you can think of the first kind of wildly popular version of the American Revolution that you that really jazzed you up as a young person. Because I was, if you look back at, say, the movie, it was a Broadway musical and then a movie, 1776, which was done.
I didn't watch any of that stuff. History growing up. I liked to hear about it. I wasn't into some total picture of it. I did love Stan Freberg, who presented a record on the history of yep. the United States, which was musical, and it was sort of hilarious and irreverent. And I learned as much from that as anything. But the real story. You do not diminish the inspirational nature of this
right.
by complicating it with the violence, by complicating
with
it yeah. with all the undertow. And that's the important thing. And I think there are those who want to sanitize it. And if they get down to narrowing it down so that it only has just heritage and blood, then it's right. got to be a Native American story. It can't yeah. be a white Protestant story.
So I guess what I'm saying, what I'm trying to do is I believe that history is always, written with the present in mind, and it reflects what we're going through as a country. And 1776 hit Broadway in the late 60s as, the Vietnam War was tearing people apart, the federal government, particularly under LBJ, and then Nixon was held in low esteem, rightly. 40 years later or whatever it is, you get something like Hamilton, which is a kind of fascinating and fun and imaginative re-envisioning of what is possible. Like, how can you, thinking of the founding fathers as black men and women, doing rap songs is a far cry from 1776. And it's, and then we have things like the 1619 Project and Trump's revisionism. And it seems like, I'm hoping that your series augurs is that we're in a new age of nuance and of sophistication where it's like, okay, we've tried to be harshly ideological and reductionist, you know, in every possible direction. Let's start looking at this stuff.
The story is, it, you know, is itself. I mean, the great discipline that we have, and it, of course, echoes and rhymes, as Mark Twain might say, with everything that's going on at any time. But I began this project when Barack Obama had 13 months to go in his presidency. There's been a lot of water under the American bridge. At times it rhymes in one way and then doesn't rhyme in another, and the rhymes now. But it's our discipline to don't pay any attention to them. You know that will happen because human nature remains the same. The Bible, the Old Testament said it. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. That's Ecclesiastes. Nothing new under the sun means human nature doesn't change. And that's basically true, except on July 4, 1776, something changed, because everybody, most everybody up to that moment was a subject. And there were a few people clinging to the Eastern Seaboard who are now citizens, and that bore with it great responsibility. And we were trying to eventually win a revolution and put in place a government that would reflect the newest ideas of humankind. The second sentence of the Declaration is the second most important sentence in the English language after "I love you." And that is true. And it is, you know, Jefferson originally wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable," which would be a reasonable way in the Enlightenment to say, we're sort of proposing these ideas. And Franklin saying, and we did a film on Benjamin Franklin, and one of our commentators said, it's the old lawyer's dodge, tell them it's self-evident. There's nothing self-evident about these truths. What we're about to tell you are completely new in the world. And as Paine says, you know, not since the time of Noah do we have a chance to begin again, which is meaning this is a moment of reset for human nature. So I think the American Revolution is the most important event since the birth of Christ. Now, it's provocative, I suppose, but it gets people thinking. I met a French professor at Brown University. She said, I think it's the French Revolution. I said, how did that work out? And then someone said to me, it's the Renaissance. I said, really good response. That's a good answer. If I was a Muslim scholar thinking about what was going on in the Muslim empires of the of Persia in during our dark ages, where the greatest philosophical and ethical and religious and scientific and astronomical and mathematical thinking was going on, I would say that was it. But we started the oldest republic on earth at that moment, and for 249 years, it's worked pretty damn well.
Well, and also, as you pointed out, it you know, the logic in the Declaration and in the fight for freedom kind of, it has this force where it includes more and more people. I was thinking as I was preparing for this.
That's a huge point that you made.
Yeah, well.
Really huge point.
Because, you know, Frederick Douglass, who knew slavery, right? He said, you know, that the Declaration is a glorious, and the Constitution were glorious liberty documents. But then the poet Audre Lorde, you know, said something that still is used at a feminist convention in the early 70s, where she said, you know, you can't use the master's tools to deconstruct or to destroy the master's house. It seems that's wrong, right? That the kind of matrix of rights and actions that happened in the revolution work, they're not contained. They keep moving outward to include more and more people.
That's exactly right. When Thomas Jefferson said all men are created equal, he meant all white men of property free of debt. In fact, the founders to a person thought they were creating a republican kind of aristocracy of talent in which only those property-owning men would make the decisions for everybody else. In order to win that revolution, they had to invite teenagers and ne'er-do-wells and felons and recent immigrants without any land and second and third sons without the chance of an inheritance, and they win the war. And so democracy, which we celebrate as the product of the American Revolution, was not the object of it.
Right.
It scared the hell out of the founders, but they understood. And so if you look at it, where it's democracy is kind of a process thing. All aspects of the Declaration and our other founding document, the Constitution, are about that. We say the pursuit of happiness. We think everybody, it's about the accumulation of material wealth. Our founders, almost to a man, thought it meant lifelong learning, that you would be more virtuous.
Partly because they were wealthy.
And earn the right of citizenship by being. No, not that, because even John Adams is anxious. There's too much too much avarice and ambitious, too much lust for profit, not enough virtue to sustain it. Yeah. He's worried about. But what they did do is put that word pursuit, which is the key word, and then a more perfect union. So we're a nation in the process of becoming. And as Yuval Levin says, when you say all, you've just broken down the door. It just, it, no matter what you think you're limiting, when you say all, that word now is the radioactive word that is going to obtain. And that, to me, is a pretty terrific understanding.
Well, and you, there's a moment in the series where you're talking about how even as the Continental Congress was working on the Declaration,
they're in the same building.
The Pennsylvania colony people are making their constitution.
State of, the Commonwealth
that
of Pennsylvania
is really blowing the doors off of who counts.
Yeah, they're doing what you said. They're expanding the notion of it, and of course we're going to outlaw slavery and expand the notion of who gets the franchise. We're going to do it to women. We're going to do it. We're going to permit gay marriage. All these things are going to happen, because it's a constantly. I mean, it's an expanding universe. This is our Big Bang. I want to look back and figure out what are the elements of it. But as you know, you have to do it scientifically. You can't say, well, my theory of this is that it's slavery, or my theory of this. I think slavery is a hugely important thing. What Lord Dunmore did was unbelievably cynical. The entire wealth of the British Empire is dependent upon slave labor in the Caribbean. He himself owns slaves. He's not freeing any of them. He wishes to free only those slaves of rebels. That means those of you who are slaves of loyalists have to remain slaves. It's a disaster. It does anger people, but it doesn't mean that the American Revolution or the American nation is propagated just on slavery. It does say, as one of our consultants says, very clearly that one side is unevenly attached to slavery, Britain, and the other is fully engaged with it, our side. But this is just the reality. And if you just call balls and strikes, then you have an opportunity to invite everyone in to participation in this story, and not, the purpose of the present isn't to go tisk tisk and wag your finger at the past, nor is it to make it morning again in America and have a sanitized Madison Avenue view of everything. George Washington is complicated, and it's all the more impressive that he's the guy who's indispensable even with all these complications. And they knew it. He knew that slavery was wrong, and he freed his slaves at his death. Jefferson knew it was wrong. And, you know, the black scholar, Annette Gordon Reed, says, how could you do something if you knew it was wrong? She said, well, that's the human question for all of us. Right. She's not taking Jefferson off the hook. She's leaving him on the hook, but placing the rest of us our own inconsistencies. Yeah. This is the important ingredient, that we are all this foibles. We all have these foibles. And, you know, my ancestor, Robert Burns, the poet, said, oh, it's some power of the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us. Yeah. And if you, I mean, so easy. We made a film on Prohibition, and it begins with a quote from Mark Twain that says, nothing so needs reforming as other people's habits.
Right?
Because we are happy to tell you what's wrong with you. We are unhappy to accept, look in the mirror and accept what may be wrong with me.
Can I ask a kind of production question? Because you mentioned Annette Gordon Reed, who is best known for her work kind of showing the relationship between Jefferson and Sally Hemings, and really changed a large interpretation of Jefferson. She was at odds in that fight, in that academic fight, with somebody else who's in the movie or in the series, Joseph Ellis. When you talk to people, like, do they know who else you're talking to? And like, how do you?
Not necessarily, but we're not there to have arguments. And that's the problem. A modern media is there to say, you know, well, you know, it's sort of that old, you know, satire of the counterpoint, you know,
point counterpoint, and, you know, Jane, you ignorant slut, the old 60 minutes thing.
And so we don't operate that way. Joe Ellis is in our film and contributes mightily. Annette Gordon Reed, we don't say she's the author of the Hemingses of Monticello. We just say these people know. Kathleen Duvall just won the Pulitzer Prize for this amazing book called Native Nations, about the plurality of nations that occupy our western border, and those Native Americans who have assimilated or are coexisting or have been, you know,
wiped out
by that, or move west in refuge huge from it. And Native Americans make much more dire choices. They mm-hmm. they some choose to be because they've intermarried or connected with and trust the colonists, the patriots, and others assume that if they cast their lot with the Brits, things will be good for them. Yeah. It's bad for them no matter what happens. They've lost everything, regardless of who wins.
Right, right.
They've lost everything. And so that's a dynamic, because it's their land, yeah. that is as important as any right. attempt to sort of find slavery as the cause for all of that.
One of the things that's fascinating is the emphasis, or not emphasis, but the inclusion of Native Americans and kind of the conception of them that they were as varied as Europe.
That's is that you so could have that, the Delaware and the Shawnee and their allies, but there could be different linguistic things. Yeah. They could be as different from one to another right. as, say, the French are from the Prussians, or somebody from Virginia is from Massachusetts. And if you can't tell that story, what business have you trying to understand the revolution? Mm-hmm. Because it is about the prize of North America. And the word prize does not mean the idea of North America. Right. It doesn't mean the
stuff,
language
right?
of
it's or the timber,
it's the
it's
land.
The beaver pelt,
it's the land, and
the water.
Opening quote is from Conestoga after you hear from Thomas Paine, who gives the name of every episode. Mm-hmm. You hear from Conestoga, spokesman for the Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee, right. that so inspired Franklin to think that maybe right. there could be a union of states, which failed because nobody wanted to give up their autonomy,
right.
but 20 years later was instrumental in doing it. But he models it on this Native American. There's five and then six distinct tribes, right. the Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Tuscarora, mm-hmm. Oneida, and Mohawk, who have their own cultures but have been world players on the global scene mm-hmm. diplomatically and economically for centuries. And they're not naive. They understand, and their villages, they're not living in teepees. You could come across in upstate New York a settlement, and it would have clapboard houses and window panes, and until you saw human beings, you wouldn't know whether this was English colonists or Native Americans.
Why does it take us so long to get to that level of sophistication?
I think a lot of it is just the desire to use history as an instrumentality of the present. Another is that this is a big deal, our revolution, and I think there is a fear that if you roil the waters with the complications, that it will diminish the big ideas. The big ideas are big ideas. Nothing can touch them.
So a big part of, and I guess there are no spoiler alerts, right, in a series about the American Revolution.
Well, but I'll say that it's really important, and you can spoil this thing, and it's perfectly all right. But let us remember that they didn't know that. David McCullough used to say there's no foreseeable future in history.
Right.
Nobody knows how it's going to turn out. Even when the French come in Washington, when the British take Charleston, he's certain it's going to end. Yep. And you want to, good history is wanting to go in thinking it might not turn out the way you know it did. I have people come to me all the time in the last 35 years after my Civil War series came out saying, I watched the last episode and I hope that this time in the Ford Theater, the gun would jam. Yeah. And I do too. So let's remember, George Washington did not know he was George Washington. That he'd be on the dollar bill, that he'd be on the quarter, that there'd be a big pointy thing in the national capital named for him, that there'd be a state on the other side of the continent named for him, and that every other state had a city or a county named for him. He had no idea that was going to happen.
So what I was going to say is that what the series stresses at the end of the revolution, it is not clear what that means. A certain amount of freedom and liberty has prevailed, but what happens next? And you had mentioned before that Washington, part of his genius was to get, people in Massachusetts and Georgia to realize they're on the same side. We are in a particular moment, it seems, of disunity among the states, among the country. We're polarized. We talk about red and blue and, never the twain shall meet. What are the lessons from what happened after the revolution was won that you think are most important for America in 2025 and going into the 250th
year? Well, we don't make films to have lessons for people. Yeah. We want to tell a good story, and then everyone can take their lesson. But I think it's obvious that if you're a Chicken Little and worried that the sky is falling and that we're so divided, we're way more divided during the Revolution. Mm-hmm. Loyalists were killing Patriots, and Patriots were killing Loyalists, and everybody was killing the disaffected, and there were armies occupying, standing armies occupying cities, and whole provinces, as they call them, were pacified, and then, oops, have to admit that they're not pacified. Sounds like a Vietnam War scenario. Yep. So there's a kind of optimism that you develop in history. There are aspects of today that are unprecedented, and there are aspects that are familiar, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that being an optimist is not a naive nor pejorative condition. It is a reasonable reaction to watching human beings throughout history. And if you know where you've been, you have a better sense of where you are and where you may be going. And my hope, if there was a hope that I could attribute to this 10 years of effort that my co-director Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt and our wonderful team and our writer Jeff Ward, I think I could speak from them, is that some desire to put the us back in the U.S. It is frayed, but it's been frayed in Vietnam. It's frayed at times in Depression, certainly during our Civil War when we murdered 750,000 of our own. I mean, people, if it bleeds, it leads is a journalistic sort of error. I mean, Will and Ariel Durand, a husband, wife, historian, figured out that there was only 38 years, I'm making this up, when there weren't wars. They missed what was going on of those 38 years. This is what human beings do. They kill each other. It's a horrible thing. And so you tell wars not to glorify it, but to reveal how terrible it is. And to be in a war in the late 18th century in which you die by muskets or cannon
or bayonet,
which is worse than you could possibly imagine. Yeah. We have a moment in this film. We don't make loyalists the enemies. We follow a loyalist, John Peters, who kills his best friend growing up on a rampart at a redoubt at Bennington, a battle he's about to lose. And his friend Jeremiah Post says, "Peters, you damn Tory," another derogatory term for a loyalist, stabs him with his bayonet. It's deflected by the bone. And Peter says the most chilling thing in the film, "I was obliged to destroy him," meaning boom, shot him in the head with his pistol. On the other side of it, Roger Lamb, who's a wonderful Irish soldier who not only keeps the journals, but he writes pictures with it, describes a lull. All soldiers love lulls in the Battle of Saratoga, and the Brits are on the north side of this river that's running into the Hudson, and the Americans are on the south side, and all of it, and they're trading barbs and insults and whatever you do in a lull. You're not firing. And then all of a sudden, a British soldier runs down to the water, jumps in the water, and swims. And meanwhile, an American does the same thing. And we're zooming in on the page of his beautiful drawings and texts. And there is a stick figures of two brothers in the water hugging each other. And that's it. They're brothers. Yeah. They had not known they were fighting each other. They hadn't seen each other for years. And they suddenly realized they were on opposing armies in this gigantic global war. And so, you know, William Blake, the romantic poet, said you could find the universe in a grain of sand. Yeah. We can find it in that grain of sand that Roger Lamb recorded, and in John Peters, killing his best friend in the middle of the Revolution. And there's so many other moments like that that reflect a much larger, a more complicated, a more varied kind of take than just, you know, buckles and hose and breeches and waistcoats and powdered
fights
wigs
and in
fife and drum. And that's what I thought, you know, when we were doing this. No, when we started, nobody talked 250. It was took us years and years and years before I thought, hey, you know, if we finished early, we could be out for the 250th of Lexington and Concord this past April. No, Sarah Botstein, the much wiser co-director, said, "We'll be still onlining and mixing," and she was right. I said, "Well, at least we'll be in before we can have a complicated discussion before we're drowning in fife and drum treacle." And then you see, oh, it's a tug of war over ideologies. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's superficial. Oh, it's complicated. Whatever. I'm just happy to have something that we could all share in. Mm-hmm. In which, I mean, I have traveled the country. I have spoken to, I've said the same thing to Joe Rogan as I said to the editorial board of the New York Times, as I said to inner city school kids in Charleston and Detroit and Chicago and suburban kids and audiences. I've said the same message. And most of what comes back when we share clip reels and tell stories is, I had no idea. And that means there is a huge reservoir of curiosity that those divisions that may be implacable are in fact probably a mile wide, but only an inch thick. Yeah. And if you can provide people with a shared history, maybe we can go into the semi-quincentennial, there I said it, more inspired by what our founders intended and less inspired by the incredibly boring adherence to whatever the current dialectic is. You know, these binaries are non-existent in nature. They're invented. We live in a computer world. It's a one or a zero. We live in a media culture. It's my way or the highway. And life, as we know in our own relationships and the dramas that we're drawn to, fiction and real, are much more complicated and much more interesting.
We're recording this in New York. It's a city that you've done a lot of documenting of, and you lived here at various points. Thomas Paine, who opens, you know, the series and provides the chapter titles, died here. New York, though, was occupied. I mean, it's a major battlefield in the Revolution. It was occupied by the British for much of the war. What is essential about New York in the Revolutionary period?
It's just huge and important. You know, when Washington is able to get Henry Knox to bring the cannon that Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold have captured from the British at Ticonderoga and bring it and put it up on Dorchester Heights, and the Brits wake up and they're there and they're, we're out of here, and they go to Halifax. The Massachusetts Assembly says to Washington, congratulations, hope you enjoy your retirement. He goes, what are you talking about? They're going to come back to New York. So he goes to New York. He's undermanned. The British come with massive amounts of force. Washington makes an unbelievable tactical mistake in the Battle of Long Island, the biggest battle, in August of 1776. It's just the month after the Declaration. He, you know, by September 15th, the British are occupying New York. They don't give it up until November 25th, 1783. That is 7 years and 2+ months. It is a loyalist and a British stronghold. It is the stronghold. I mean, Charleston and Savannah later on to some extent. And this is the final disembarkation of loyalists, their property, human and otherwise, and the troops, German and otherwise, takes place from New York. And it's then that Washington can come back and take care of its city. New York is hugely symbolic of a war we don't understand. And if you just go the blocks that we are at right now, we are between Broadway, which has always been there, and Lafayette, named for Lafayette. If you go one block west of Broadway, you get to Mercer, a general who was wounded and died of his wounds in the Battle of Princeton. If you go to the next street, it's Green, after Nathaniel Green, the second most important general.
And then you've got
after
Sullivan and then you have McDougall,
I mean, Worcester, Worcester, and then you have West Broadway, doesn't count. Worcester was a general. You have Thompson, who was a general. Then you have Sullivan, who is a very important general from my state of New Hampshire. And then you have McDougall, who was less important, but they were all together in the
I'm just saying everything
and Varick,
here.
This is a graveyard of revolutionary heroes. They used to have other names for these streets, but they're trying to say, this is the pantheon of people who made this responsible. And the fact that they're doing, and New York didn't go much over Canal Street by even by the end of the war, but it's an important statement that we're going to name it after the people who helped deliver us from the British.
Is that part of the genius of New York? And, you know, we're in New York. We both like New York. I was born in New York. I moved back to New York. I'm kind of a New York exceptionalist. Is part of the genius of New York that that's all there, and it's almost as if people don't know or don't care?
Well, New York has always been about the almighty dollar, which has always been, even from the Dutch on, which means that you're in an all-consuming and thereby forgettable present, and you're blissfully unaware of the historical tides. Fortunately, somebody along the line realized we ought to name these streets, and it takes only a little bit of questioning and a little bit of Googling to find out everything you know from Varick, and beyond Varick is Hudson Street, where the river used to be, and where the river was is Washington Street. So you've just now done a short history of the American Revolution just in a series of 10 blocks in a tiny neighborhood in Lower Manhattan. So, you know, New York is an interesting center of everything. I mean, we're now in this middle of, speaking of sky is falling, you know, a democratic socialist. And you have to say, you know, as an American, I am more worried about dictators than I am about democratic socialists. Many of our allies were or still are democratic socialists. Right. Democratic socialists don't kill people. National socialists do. And those are the ones you want to be
worried about. Socialists, international socialists have a bad record.
Not as bad as communist regimes and totalitarian regimes.
Of course. Are you a fan of the no kings rhetoric?
Because this
seems to be harkening back to a revolution that we once had.
I think there is a sense that the monarchical tendencies aren't us, and so I understand where it comes from. There's a wonderful character in our film named Johann Ewald, Captain Johann Ewald, who we follow throughout the film. Mm-hmm. He's a Hessian. Yeah. He arrives in our third episode when Hessians arrive.
Sorry, just to interrupt briefly, the portrait that you paint of the Hessians is incredible, because my understanding of them superficially was these were like fat, you know, soldiers for hire who slept and got their lunch eaten, you know, at Trenton on Christmas Day. They're the scariest people on the planet.
They're really good, tough soldiers. And Britain's army has been depleted. The Navy's the best in the world, but the Army's nothing. And so they hire these soldiers, and they come over, and Americans are terrified of them. Yeah. And they're sort of built. Their helmets are make them look taller. They wear whiskers. Most everyone is clean shaven in this time.
So they look bulky.
They basically do that. So they, you know, the German generals at the Battle of Long Island. And Heister is openly contemptuous of the Americans, who seem to drop everything and run at the first sight of them. But Johann Ewald is a character, and he's openly contemptuous of the American position and of, you know, what Thomas Paine is promoting and all of this stuff. But he's part of the surrendering army at Yorktown, and he says this thing: who would have thought 100 years ago that out of this multitude of rabble should arise a people who could defy kings? And that's basically somebody summing it up. And those German soldiers, when they deserted, would just blend into German-speaking communities, who, when they were prisoners of war and escaped, would go into German-speaking. Those that went home, a lot of them came back with their families to resettle the continent. And so I think this is where it comes. When you make anything two-dimensional, you lose the opportunity for dynamics and dimension. And here you have a German who's been openly contemptuous of our idea, who at the end has to admit that our idea is pretty impressive if this multitude of rabble could defy kings. It's just one hell of a good story. That's all it is. You don't need to superimpose any historiography. You don't have to have some theory of operation. You just have to call balls and strikes.
You are a huge advocate for public broadcasting.
I am.
That's been the showcase of your work throughout your career. How do you feel about the zeroing out or reducing of things, budget lines for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
I think it's incredibly short-sighted. The Broadcasting Act, one of the Great Society programs, designed to do exactly what it's done. It's the largest network on earth. I don't know NPR as much, but there are 338 affiliate stations in the network.
I think it's the single largest radio.
It's the biggest. So. I think that NPR is too, but PBS is certainly the largest network. It reaches in. It's had devastating effects to my budget. There's been huge cuts at PBS. We'll survive. But what it's done is incredibly short-sighted. It's killing most of the rural stations who depend on their CPB money more than anything else. It's not just our children's programming in prime time they're interested in. They get continuing education, classroom of the year, homeland security reports, and emergency signals. Those are disappearing. There'll be news deserts. Nobody will be covering the school board or the city council in those places. And maybe that's the intention of it, but it's an incredibly short-sighted decision.
Challenge a bit on this, because the laws or the legislation that created public broadcasting is late 60s. The world has changed so much. Do we need to have government funded broadcasting?
Absolutely.
How do you separate that from state broadcasting?
None of the films I've made could have been made anywhere else.
I'll give you an example.
My Vietnam series took 10 and a half years to make. I had to raise money for 10 of those 10 and a half years.
Where did you get the money from?
From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, from PBS, from private individuals, from foundations and things like that. It's always corporations.
How do any movies get made, though? If
would you let me finish?
Okay. Yeah.
It's really important that I finish this story.
Okay.
So I have a four-legged stool of support, and one has been eliminated. That's the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the single biggest part of this. Private individuals, foundations, and corporate Bank of America has been for the last 19 years. Before that, it was General Motors for about the same amount of period. So I could, with my reputation, have gone into a premium cable or a streaming service. These are the likely outlets in your world where you would do this in the marketplace that should act as the great leveling thing. And I could probably, in one pitch, as long as you and I have been talking, get the $30 million that I needed to do this. I think so. I don't think I'm being arrogant. I've got a good reputation. I've been doing this for 45 years. They would not give me 10 years, 10 and a half years, which is what it took me. This is, it's like a government grant for a science thing. It's not like, we need the cure to cancer next Thursday. Mm-hmm. No, we need you to explore stem cells, or we need you to look at CRISPR, or we need you to do more information on radiation. We are able to incubate and tell complex stories that are free of the pressures of the marketplace. There is not a suit telling me make it longer or shorter, sexier or less sexy, more violent or less violent. We are able to tell a complex story, and that happens, has happened so far within the confines. PBS will go on and will survive, but the sad thing is, are those rural stations, somebody coming up who may be the next person.
That's a separate issue though, right? That the rural stations get, you know, 30%
No, they're part of the system that shows this stuff too. They sometimes
so
80,
it's the distribution
80 or 90%.
That you are as much worried about.
No, it's the existence of these rural stations. It's the ability to touch Americans with that. Yeah. It's going to be devastating in Alaska and the Dakotas, eastern Tennessee, places like this, in which the PBA station may be the only signal they have. That may be the intention of zeroing it out.
Yeah, when you say that, what do you mean by that?
What do you mean? I just explained it twice.
I mean, that's because Donald Trump doesn't want Alaska to have local news.
No, it's just that a decision, that the perception that there's a couple of shows that may have been shown a bias. This is the network that had William F. Buckley, the leading conservative in the country, who had a show for 32 years called Firing Line. Yeah. That show is still on and still, you got to let me finish sentences.
Okay.
It's still on and still has a conservative as a moderator. So I don't get, and most of the stuff is like Antique Roadshow and Nova and Masterpiece Theater and my historical stuff. I have no political axe to grind. I throw fastballs down the center of the pike to continue the baseball metaphor. This is a hugely valuable system, and there's lots of areas in which the government of the United States, and President Reagan said this out loud, and he said it to me personally when he asked me about the funding for my Civil War film, and I told him that the initial seed money had come from the National Endowment for the Humanities. He says, that's perfect. So you get the government primes the punt, and then the private, General Motors in this case, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, couple foundations came in, and that was the whole budget for the Civil War series.
But that means
it would not have been produced anywhere else.
Well, maybe, or in a different way, right?
Or in a different way, which means the Civil War dramas like North versus South, heaving bosom against heaving bosom is what I called it. Somehow you can fight and then you can walk into the copse of trees and there's your love who is there by the side of it.
You're a John Jakes critic, let's put it that
way, right? I am a critic of what they made of his work.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it's not a question of whether PBS is, you know, right leaning or left leaning or anything like that. It strikes me as a tax that we shouldn't have to pay, particularly in this day and age. But I respect your opinion and obviously respect your work.
There are many other taxes that you pay
that I really don't want to pay.
I'll tell you that I received a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities of $1,449,500 for the Civil War. I paid all of that back. Yeah. You tell me that McDonnell Douglas or Boeing or Lockheed have paid back all the developments for any weapon system they have, or put a percentage of the profit on the sale of those planes to Saudi Arabia or others. I'd be much more worried about that, because the whole budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is half a bomber.
Right. Look, you're not going to get an argument from me that the military-industrial complex is all wrong, right? What do you do next, Ken Burns?
I've been working for many years on a project about LBJ and the Great Society.
Oh, really?
I've been doing a film that I've wanted to do, and we've been working for several years on it since the Civil War series came out in 1990 on Reconstruction, the most misunderstood period. Yeah. We're calling it Emancipation to Exodus, meaning we're backing up to self-emancipation that's taking place in the years leading up to the Civil War, and then extending all the way to the Great Migration that begins at the end of the second decade of the 20th century and extends for six decades, but we don't go that far.
Are
leaving in number
south,
because Jim Crow is so intolerable. Yeah. You can't be a mother and have your kid go off to school and worry about whether your son comes back alive and not a law protecting the murderers of that son who just decide to shoot him by the side of the road. And that happens all the time. Mm. And so we're doing that. I had the opportunity to do eight two-hour interviews with Barack Obama over the last 4 years. I've got a couple more to go. No rush on it, but eventually, when we escape the specific gravity of what you and I might agree would be journalistic area, you know, get into historical realm where scholarship is beginning to triangulate some of the things, that I would do a series sort of as we did on the Roosevelts or on Muhammad Ali or something like that. And then we've been filming people who knew Dr. King, not just the famous folks. We did get the last interview, I think, of John Lewis and Harry Belafonte, but people who picked him up at the Albany, Georgia airport and put him to bed and gave him a meal and took him to church the next day. So just the foot soldiers of the civil rights thing. Mm. I'm interested in, I really want to do a film on, for many years it was a film on the Cold War, but now I'm changing it to the CIA. I think you get the Cold War with the CIA, but you also get some really internal dramatic stuff that it can be hooks, so the complicated aspects of the Cold War can sort of be attached to individual stories that make it interesting. I'm also interested in innovation and technology, sort of almost Eli Whitney to Steve Jobs. Yeah. You know, it's sort of like Eli Whitney reinvigorates slavery by inventing the cotton gin, but he also is inventing movable parts and an assembly line to ensure the Northern dominance in the Civil War that's going to come. And Steve Jobs invents, you know, something that none of us can do without, but is also as much a prison. And he was a dear friend. And, I just really admired him. He has every Mac computer, every photographic and movie software has the Ken Burns effect on it, which is a crude variation of what we do to try to wake up the old photographs or paintings in the case of the American Revolution. But, you know, there's a double-edged sword to so much of technology that, and American history is in some ways so defined by these technological advances, whether the steam engine or the telegraph or the telephone or the phonograph or the movies or
all of these things,
the airplane.
So as a final question, I guess, you know, we talked about how at the end of the American Revolution, your series talks about this, that unity is not a given among the states that emerge victorious. And you've talked about how democracy is a process, and, you know, it's partly it's people like George Washington, partly it's this process. At this stage, where do you look for, because you're optimistic about the American project, obviously, where do we look for to build in more unity? And is it a mix of figures and process? And where does that process come from?
I think that's a wonderful question. I don't know what the answer is. I know that if you know where you've been, you know better where you are, and where you might be going. Mm-hmm. And that means that history is the best teacher. And that,
but it doesn't teach specific lessons, right? It's complicated.
It could. It is complicated, and it teaches complicated lessons, which is what you need in order to live in a always complicated world. The idea, the great arrogance of the present is somehow because we've got these devices and all of these cameras, and we know more than George Washington. No, I mean, he was the finest horseman of the age. Do you ride horses?
I do not.
Okay, neither do I. Could you shoe a horse if your life depended on it?
I absolutely could not.
Neither could I. Yeah. And so, you know, you can reboot your computer, so can I.
I can do that most of the time,
And George Washington can't, but it doesn't mean that you can start making those kinds of comparisons. And let's just say it isn't just a trade-off between the George Washingtons and the sort of the sort of withered democracy. There are a lot of people, right? Babe Ruth comes up once every nine times at bat. So, you know, there are lots of people who are middle infielders who are central to the success of the story. We follow a 15-year-old kid who signs up when he's 15 years old, Joseph Plum Martin. He's like the prototypical grunt. He complains about the officers, complains about, but does everything, and he's over the redoubt number 10, which is where Lafayette and Hamilton are, but he's one of the first over the thing. The guy next to him is shot and cries. He says, it falls crying bitterly, but there was no stopping us. Through the abatis, the sharpened logs, and they take over redoubt number 10. It's a very famous painting, but what you forget is that they bring up the big French guns that have been able to come in from Newport because the French Navy has held the British Navy in check outside of the opening of the Chesapeake. They've hauled these guns up, and it's over for Cornwallis. Yep. The surrender happens, and it's people like Joseph Plum Martin that does it. It's like who lands at Normandy Beach? Ike is in London, right? The generals, you know, there are some generals on the ground, but, you know, it is mostly people who have no interest in empire. They're not going to be rewarded for this. They're not going to get property in Europe from landing there. There may be from Iowa and whatever, and they don't understand the complex geopolitical moment that has brought us there, but they get us through. And there's the Joseph Plum Martins of history, the John Greenwood, who's 14, not even 15 years old when he starts the war. There's Betsy Ambler, a 10-year-old when the war begins in Virginia, who's an exile, who's in a refugee for most of the war. We don't think of Americans as refugees. There's James Fortin, a 9-year-old black kid, free black kid in Philadelphia, who hears the first public reading of the Declaration and doesn't for a second believe that it doesn't apply to him. Mm-hmm. He does apply to him, and he ends up funding the abolition movement as a rich old man. His granddaughter comes down during the Civil War to help teach a newly, can't say emancipated, but newly liberated black people because of Union victories on the coast. I mean, it's the tapestry of American history cannot be isolated to a few bold-faced names, nor can you just say that those unheralded people from the bottom up should therefore throw out, we should cancel the other people. The cancellation process is ridiculous because we're all cancelable, all of us.
Yeah.
And that's where Annette Gordon-Reed, when she said, you know, why would he continue doing something, slavery, if he knew it was wrong about Jefferson? Well, that's the human question for all of us. Mm. Not letting Jefferson off the hook, putting us on the hook. Right. And that's what I think the part that art does, that good storytelling does, is it reminds you that it's not the question, who are we? Which is my animating question, but a much more difficult one, who am I?
Yeah.
And that this art, these histories, these stories hold a mirror up in which I now have to think about what my ancestor Robert Burns said, oh, would some power the gift to give us to see ourselves as others.
First encountered that in an episode of a New York-based sitcom, The Odd Couple.
Oh my goodness.
At one point, Felix Unger does that in a Scottish burr.
Last two lines of To a Louse.
Yeah. Final question. You live in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a famously libertarian state. You have, in the way past, called yourself a yellow dog Democrat. It seems like you lean progressive. How does it feel to live in New Hampshire with the Free State Project and all of this terrible, terrible liberty and freedom all around you?
Well, we like live free or die is the motto of our country. It's actually, people have misinterpreted it. It's live, freeze, and die. One is completely unaware of the free state, of the libertarian aspects of it. There's libertarian aspects in New York City that are much more prevalent and much more well-funded than they are in New Hampshire. you know,
you have libertarian sensibilities for certain things, right? Free speech, lifestyle, freedom, tolerance.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I wouldn't call them libertarian thing only because it's a label. I subscribe to the Constitution and its amendments. And the first one is loaded with lots of good things. Right. No establishment of a religion. Right, yeah. Thomas Jefferson said, if my neighbor believes in 20 gods or no god at all, it neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg.
You mentioned the birth of Jesus as being a big deal in world history. Are you at all a Christian or lapsed Christian or deathbed Christian?
I wouldn't call it that. That seems so cynical. I'm born Christian and I don't go to church, but I sort of think I said the birth of Jesus Christ because it's a historical event.
Absolutely.
And it has animated so much of world history, good, bad, and otherwise, and that I think the American Revolution is the most important event since the birth of Christ.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Ken Burns, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you.